Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, welcome back to the Interpreter Show. Once again, I'm Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley and Stephen Smoot. And we have Hales Swift joining us by phone. We apologize for the technical difficulties, so there was no commercials ringing in your ear during that little break there. But hopefully you enjoyed a moment of silence or something. I don't know. So we are going to be moving on to what's called the Gospel Advocacy section of our show today. And we have a really exciting, or by exciting I mean controversial, difficult. We have drawn the short straw, I guess we'll just say, of all the interpreter hosts. And we've got the issue of blacks and the priesthood and how God could keep priesthood from the blacks. That is our topic for gospel advocacy today. And I guess we should maybe just get the elephant in the room out right now. We are all white.
I was going to say, this is radio and you can't see us right now. But to use a Book of Mormon term, all of us right now are white as the driven snow.
And, yeah. and I want to maybe even add to that, we're also none of us. I'm pretty sure Hales is only a couple years older than me, I'm pretty sure. So none of us actually lived through the era in which the priesthood ban was in force. And correct. So this is something that we really only can know and learn from, you know, by reading about it, hearing stories about it from people who did experience it. You know, we are mostly like here to learn on this topic ourselves, I think, more than anything else. So hopefully we have some good, we'll have some good thoughts and perspective here. But, you know, we would just like to be sensitive to that fact that, you know, we're as much learning about this as anybody else. And we're trying to learn from the points of view of the people who did experience it, the people who have done the research on it and things like that. So
just by way of a very brief historical sketch of what we're talking about here, basically the idea is that during the period of Brigham Young, there was a point in which he officially banned black members of the church from holding the priesthood. I believe that was 1852 or 3.
Well, 46, 47 is when you start to get the first sort of inclinations of it. But yes, I believe the official ban is formulated in 1852, around the same time that Utah ratifies the act on service, quote unquote.
And then the restrictions on the temple are made explicit in like 1878 or something like that, I want to say. But then from then on, you have about 100 years plus where black members of the church are not holding the priesthood, are not allowed to participate in temple ordinances, all the way until 1978 when Spencer W. Kimball receives a revelation that's ratified by the Quorum of the Twelve that then becomes official declaration number 2 that allows black members of the church to have all of the blessings of the gospel. And that has been what we've experienced ever since. In 2013, the church released a gospel topics essay on this issue, race in the priesthood. And recently, Deseret Book has been releasing a series on difficult issues in the church, one of which being race. And Stephen, I believe you've recently read Paul Reeves' take on race and the priesthood in the Let's Talk About series. Do you want to give a little synopsis of your thoughts there?
Sure, a little book report. So there's a nice little series out through Deseret Book, Let's Talk About Blank. And they have Race and the Priesthood is one I have with me here right now. They have one in Book of Abraham, Book of Mormon Translation, polygamy, all sorts of the temple, all sorts of subjects, right? So I like them. They're nice little cheap volumes. You get for like $10 a pop at Deseret Book. They're very easy. They're easy and accessible. And W. Paul Reeve is a professor at the University of Utah. He teaches history up there, and he's been working on the racial history of quote-unquote Mormonism for the last little while. Paul Reeve is probably most famous for his book, Religion of a Different Color, which he published with Oxford University Press, I want to say 2013 or 14. So he's been doing this for a while. He's not a neophyte.
I think it was 2015.
2015
actually.
Even? Yeah. Okay.
So Russell Stevenson's book, For the Cause of Righteousness, that's 2013.
Okay, sure.
And then I think, well, maybe Reeve was 2014. I don't know.
But it's around that time, right? Yeah. There's been a recent flurry. Yes. Paul Reeve, Russell Stevenson, our friend Russell's another whose book is really good. For the cause of
Righteousness. We should have gotten him on here.
Go ahead, Hales.
We should have gotten him on here.
We should have.
So here's a quick breakdown of Paul's research, because he's been kind of been leading the charge on a new wave of research. There's a lot that we know. There's a lot new we've learned. There's still plenty of gaps. But here's kind of Paul's summary, Professor Reeve's brother, summary of it. So he breaks down the history of the racial ban and the priesthood ban into three phases. So phase one in Paul Reeve's summation is what he calls, quote, universal priesthood and temples. So between 1830 in the 1840s up until about 1847 when it's first articulated, and then 1852 when it's kind of formalized, you have a universal or a pretty universal priesthood and temple access. So regardless of creed, of color, regardless of color or ethnic background, Latter-day Saints were being invited and ordained to the priesthood and to participate in temple ordinances, okay? So that's the first phase that Reeve articulates. The second phase, he calls it, quote, segregated priesthood and temples. And this is when Brigham Young enacted a policy to, as Reeve says, to segregate the temple to make them white, to make it white only, at least in ideal policy, and that gets kind of tricky. But the idea was to have only white people come to the temple, and only white men can participate in the priesthood, can hold the priesthood. That policy is about 130 years, right? We'll say so, early 1850s to 1978. And then phase three in Paul Reeve is to say he calls it a return to racial inclusivity. Of course, June 1978, Spencer B. Kimball announces the revelation allowing all men, regardless of color or race, to hold the priesthood, and all Latter-day Saints, regardless of their race, can come into the temple. So Reeve breaks up into these three parts, and he lays out in his book a fairly pretty straightforward sort of history of what we know when these policies were enacted. You sometimes hear Latter-day Saints say, we don't really know why the priesthood ban happened. That's kind of true, but also kind of not true. So, like, we know in the sense of, like, we have dates and we have names and we have a paper trail for when this started. What is less clear were, like, what were the justifications for it? And also, the million-dollar question is, was this a revelation? Was God telling Brigham Young to do this as the prophet? Was Brigham Young as a man doing his own thing, right? That's obviously a point of contention. And also, there's some uncertainty about how, like, this was supposed to be enforced. Because the point that Paul Reeve makes throughout his book and his other research is, like, basically at no point in church history have church leaders been able to effectively implement this ban, where, like, you're supposed to have no black people or descendants of people from Africans, or the one-drop rule. Nobody with one drop of African blood is allowed to come into the temple. That just, like, never happened. And Reeve shows pretty clearly that policy was, like, impossible to enforce. And so Reeve has very boldly even – he said, like, there's been no point in church history when a black man or someone of African descent has not either held the priesthood or gone to the temple or sometimes both.
Yeah, and I've heard Russell make that same point before.
And so this is to say Reeve's book is good because he lays out the history, but he also lays out all the problems that this introduced with how to enforce this policy. There was a lot of confusion. So church leaders at several points even questioned themselves, hey, why are we doing this? Like, really, why are we doing this? Where is this coming from? What are we going to do with it? And pretty quickly, as the church expands globally, especially under Spencer B. Kimball, right? David O. McKay and Spencer B. Kimball, that's when it becomes really unwieldy, because you suddenly have church members in Brazil who may not be themselves, quote unquote, black, but they clearly have, you know, African ancestors, for example. What do you do with them? Or somebody who's biracial, or, you know, a fourth black or something, right? Like, this just became totally unwieldy. Also, in the 70s, guys like Lester Bush, Reeve points out, they published new articles, new research saying
the history
is a lot more messy than we thought it was, because, hey, guess what? Joseph Smith didn't start this thing. Brigham Young did. So what do we do with that? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I recommend – and then finally, the last thing Reeve does that I'll just mention, and then I'll stop filibustering. I appreciate a lot of what Reeves does in terms of theologically challenging the arguments or the assumptions people have had for the priesthood ban. You know, Reeve is very upfront that he has his own theological beliefs about the priesthood ban. He's very clear that he does not believe the priesthood ban was from God. He doesn't believe it was inspired, and he believes the reasons given for it don't really work. And I frankly am sympathetic to a lot of his arguments on that score. But that's a little more, you know, touchy, because officially the church doesn't have an answer on whether or not this was from God or not. They just know the revelation ending it was, right? Mm-hmm. Spencer Kimmel's revelation. Mm-hmm. So there's more room there for give or take, and Reeve kind of explores some different thinking on this and gives his own perspective on it. So I recommend Reeve as a good introductory source to kind of show what's the current state on our knowledge of this subject. And then from there, you can kind of branch out into theology, the stories. Reeve has lots of stories of Black Latter-day Saints who joined the church before the priesthood ban was lifted. Uh-huh. And like their stories or experiences, actually really quite faith promoting. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like really. And I don't just mean that, like, I don't mean to be glib or whatever, but like genuinely faith promoting to read Black Latter-day Saints who joined a church that like officially had a policy of segregation in terms of temple and priesthood, right? Like that takes a lot of faith, mm-hmm. In order to overcome that barrier, that obstacle, and still be faithful to the church, which many of these people were.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I think it's really important. Sometimes we think we tell this story about the church's racial controversies and stuff like they're happening in some kind of vacuum, right? Like it's just this – our church is this racist institution, and, you know, the rest of the world is like – pristinely unracist or something,
yeah.
Which we know is absurd and not true. I think it's profoundly important to understand that all of this is happening against the backdrop of 19th century America, mm-hmm. right? And we are still having important conversations about race and it's the implications of racialized slavery and stuff like that. For American history, like that's the impact that's had is still being, you know, reverberating today. We're still having, you know, important conversations and debates about what those implications mean, how we should be telling our own story as Americans in regard to race. But my point here is I think that we need to maybe accept that this is not happening in a vacuum. And right. While I don't know that it's fair to say it's inevitable that there would have been a priesthood ban or something like that, I do think it is inevitable given the context in which America, you know, there were still slave states, right? Slavery yep. was still a thing,
including Missouri, by the way.
And this was a mounting political issue because you had. You know, the church was growing and coming to its own right as the slave question was becoming one of the most central issues in American politics, yeah.
And
right?
War's going to break out over war's
going to break
getting
out.
There when
you're
come on the
you're
scene.
Increasingly getting more abolitionists and more people saying, you know what, this whole slavery thing, it's really not okay, right? But then you've got a lot of retrenchment going on, especially in the South, but I don't know that it's exclusively there, right? Like
well, and besides the slavery issue, there's beyond the slavery issue, there's also the question of just like do we integrate blacks in American society?
Yeah.
What does that look like? Or do we ship them all back to Africa?
Yeah,
that was a really popular solution, quote unquote, to this question. Right? So that's another added layer to these questions, these problems.
Yeah, there is all kinds of conversations about that. There are discussions about and it's disgusting. We want to be clear about that. But there are discussions about whether or to what extent blacks are even human.
Right.
Right. There are discussions that there are theological discussions going on because they want to assign everybody some kind of descent from someone in the Bible. Right. So, you know, that's where a lot of this Curse of Cain stuff mm-hmm. comes from. You know, the church is trying to grow and establish itself in the midst of all of this. And the people who are attracted to the church and are joining the church are coming from all of these different backgrounds, right? Some people are coming up from the South with their slaves, right?
Including one of my ancestors. Cough, cough. Yeah.
Some people are coming.
It's kind of like what the Book of Mormon says about the problems with fevers in the land. It was the nature of the climate.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got people coming in, you know, most of the converts, especially early on, are from the Northeast, where slavery's less of an issue. And so
you've got your Orson Pratt abolitionists.
Yeah.
And you've got it all.
William Phelps, even, he's saying, hey, so one thing Reeve points out, in June of 1833, in the Evening and Morning Star, William Phelps, as the church's newspaper and editor in Missouri, a slave state, he publishes Free People of Color, the famous, mm-hmm. infamous editorial. And he says, hey, yeah, we're down. Free black people, come join us. Come join the Saints of Missouri.
And that's
that's not a good thing for the Missourians, right?
That really hacks off the Missourians.
Yeah. So there's a context for why some of these persecutions are happening, the maneuvering in politics and the press and things like that. Yeah.
I think because the core leadership of the church, Joseph Smith and his family, the Whitmers, William W. Phelps, even Brigham Young, they're all coming from New York.
They're Yankees.
Yankees.
Yep.
I think they kind of stepped in it, not really fully understanding.
I think so.
Because
Phelps even says as much when he publishes the retraction.
Because
later.
they grew up where it was like, of course, they grew up in an area where by then slavery was already looked down on, right? And so they kind of step in it, and I think it took a while. I think it was a struggle the whole time, really. I won't even say it took a while, but it was a struggle for them to figure out how to navigate this issue.
Right.
And then. Remember, so we talked about 1852. That's the year Brigham Young kind of gives his speech that becomes the official.
February of 1852.
February
he declares,
of 1852.
Brigham Young declares, as a prophet, but what's interesting, and Reeve points this out, he says, if no prophet has said this before, I say it now. Which is interesting because it shows that there wasn't really precedent for this thing.
No precedent, yeah.
And there's some uncertainty. So Brigham Young feels like he needs to step in and say, in February of 1852, I am saying now, black people are descendants of Cain, and therefore they are cursed, and therefore they don't get the priesthood, right? But leading up to that, you have tension. Reeve also points out, by the way, Brigham Young himself, even at his worst at this moment, right, where he says this, we have statements from Brigham Young pointing to Q. Walker Lewis and calling him one of the best elders in the church.
Yeah.
He says this in Winter Quarters, explicitly. Yeah. And he'll say, in the same breath, he'll say, you know what? Blacks can't have the priesthood, but we are all of one children of God, and who are we to stop them from being baptized? So even within the same breath in the council meetings, Brigham Young will have sometimes very racist, sometimes ambiguously, sometimes weirdly progressive comments on race
and,
or whatever, right?
And
it's
you
sort of a mixed bag.
You can do the same thing with Abraham Lincoln, right?
Yep.
And people have – people from this time period, they're very – the whole nation is really trying to grapple with this problem on a massive scale. 9 years after Brigham Young gives that speech, there's a little something called the Civil War that happens, right, in the 1861, 62, 63 – I think the Civil War goes to 65, right?
That
we're going to have this big old war over this issue, right? And it's right in the midst of that. And Utah is trying to gain statehood, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this complicated political game going on about free states and slave states. And there's always kind of we can't admit another free state until we have another slave state, because that was I think it was the Missouri Compromise what that was. There's this complicated way. I think it was actually what's his name? Thomas Kane.
Thomas Kane. He says, be pragmatic about this.
Yes.
If you try to push to be a free state, that's going to rankle people. That's going to so they kind of cut a sort of a middle ground. So Utah enters as quote unquote a slave territory, quote unquote. But the form of slavery that Utah enacts, the legislature enacts, as I understand it. It's
not a deadline.
Besides that, it is not the kind of chattel slavery the South is doing. So that's kind of a misnomer. So when people say, well, Brigham Young said that he believed in slavery, yes, we have those statements, but for Brigham Young, slavery means something different than what it meant to Jefferson Davis, for example, right? And Utah, they call it service or servitude. That's kind of their euphemistic compromise language. So, for example, you can't enslave people's kids. So if you're a slave, if your servant, your servant has a kid, you can't enslave them. You have to provide for their well-being, so you can't treat them like cattle.
They're not property;
they're not
people.
Necessarily property; they're people. There's other provisions they have in there, and it's clearly designed because they're not super. And Brigham Young will even explicitly condemn Southern slavery at certain points for being inhumane, which it absolutely was.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they're trying to navigate this weird space, doing the best that they can. What's interesting about that, too, though, is even though Brigham Young is down with this kind of sense of, we'll do this weird servitude thing, even then Orson Pratt is like, no, this is bad. And yeah. Orson Pratt is going to repeatedly oppose Brigham Young in this. Eventually, Brigham's position, you know, wins out. But again, like, there's more nuances that you're not going to get if you're reading online hot takes about, did you know that Utah was a slave state or territory?
Yeah.
Well, but yeah, kind of on the books. But again, what the territorial legislator passes is not the kind of slavery you find in Mississippi and Alabama. It just wasn't.
Yeah.
And so you need to properly gauge within its context and its historical setting what it looked like, just not to excuse it, but just to understand it and not misrepresent it, and
absolutely
to understand these nuances and these complexities.
And it was, as we were talking about, it was on the advice, the political advice of Thomas Kane, who was not a Latter-day Saint, who was kind of a savvy Washington, D.C. lobbyist, who was like the only one who actually liked the Latter-day Saints. And it was deliberately designed after the way other other
territories
were doing things at the time,
in
order to try and kind of avoid this dicey political, like, are you siding with the North or are you siding with the South? It's like, I'm going to try and not do either. And we're not saying that makes it okay by any means, but you have to understand this is the complicated world that the Latter-day Saints live in as the church is being founded and it's growing and as they're trying to establish Utah. And I think what we have to grapple with is the inevitability of racism in our history in that context, right? There was – if you think God should have found like some pristine non-racist people to build his church with, he couldn't have done it.
They weren't Americans.
Yeah, not in America anyway. It couldn't have been done. And God – doesn't like it all the time, I imagine, but he works with who he has.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important when you think about the priesthood ban to understand that this is not happening in a vacuum, and there's no magical alternative history. There's no alternative timeline where there's like no racism in our church history. Yeah. If there hadn't been a ban, there would have been something else, and we would still be grappling with it. So, again, none of that makes it okay, but I think we just have to understand we have a racist history that we have to grapple with because we're part of American history, which has a racist history.
And human history.
And
right.
human history,
racist
which has racism. And we're part of this larger conversation, and we need to put it in that larger conversation and appreciate that in that context, I think.
Right. So
my personal opinion on what the alternative probably was, because you mentioned if we had the alternative, if we had a different history, we would have gotten something else. You see plenty of churches that ended up divided into northern and southern branches or things like that over the issues of race, slavery, segregation, etc. And I can't help thinking that for all of its manifest problems, the ban had the effect of preventing a major schism in the church, and that ultimately preventing a schism that would have likely resulted in somewhat of a mass apostasy prevented damage to the church that would have been bad for all people, black, white, bond free, male, female, down the road. And because of that, I think the church is in a position to more effectively bless Heavenly Father's children because it is in one piece.
And well,
maybe there was some other way to do that. I don't know. But I guess it's been my feeling that the timing, at least, of the end of the ban was very much inspired because it was timed in such a way that many of the people who had, we'll say, struggled under some of the most serious racial biases had the chance to safely enter their eternal reward, whatever that may have been, before before the transition occurred within the church. I've run into one fellow that I know of who complained about the end of the ban. It was on my mission in Cincinnati, and at the risk of exposing my own judgmental character flaws, it was probably one of the only times I thought, the church may be better off without this guy. And he expressed his opinion about this about the end of the ban using a racist epithet and a few other not-so-choice words. But if it had happened earlier, I worry that there would have been a lot more people that became separated from the church in the same way who weren't as much of a disaster as that guy, and whose loss would have ultimately hurt people of all extractions. There's no easy, happy way to contend with issues as fraught as racism.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, speaking of the way a lot of American churches kind of have that schism north and south, there also was just – there's a lot of them that were just fully racially divided, right? You just – you had your white congregations and you had your black congregations. And that still felt in a lot of churches in the South and things like that. And, you know, for better or for worse, one of the things the ban did do was it made it so that you couldn't really do that in the church because you had to have priesthood to function in a ward. And so you had to have the blacks going to church with the whites. And and I know there was – I think there were some historical exceptions in different areas and things like that. And this history isn't particularly my strong suit. But, you know, like I said, not to justify it, but again, it is one of those things where we had to let – you know, we had to worship together and we had to figure out how to do that together. Because of the nature of this thing.
I think another way is that obviously sort of forced the issue, right? Because church leaders were confronted with these real procedural and policy decisions that have to be made. And famously, one of the biggest problems they encounter is down in Brazil. Like the United States, Brazil has a very sad history with racism and slavery. And you have plenty of Afro-Brazilians who are joining the church. And what do we do when we have full branches but no quote-unquote white people, you know, or non-African descended people to run them? So what are we going to do? We're opening up a temple in Brazil here that's in the works. What are we going to do about that? You know what I mean?
And it raises, who's even going to go there?
Who's going to go there if we can't? You know what I mean? So, like, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, sort of force the issue. I mean, there's a couple things we can more say about it. I don't want to get too far afield here. I don't know if either of you have something. One thing I thought maybe we could do, if it's okay, it might be useful to readers, to listeners. I always say that. I'm used to writing stuff to people, not speaking on a radio. It may be useful to listeners to run down just a quick list of the facts we do know that we can say.
Yeah, sure.
That way, again, kind of distilling it and then letting our listeners sort of decide for themselves. So I recommend Paul Reeves' book. The Church's Gospel Topics essay on this is very good. I'm going to shamelessly plug the fact that Mormoner.org has two articles on blacks in the priesthood. And at the end of our articles on it, we have just some quick facts, hot takes, right? So for whatever it's worth, and then any other follow-up comments we can say, here are the facts we know as of right now, as of 2023, that we can say with fair amount of confidence about the blacks in the priesthood. Okay. At least two black saints and possibly three were ordained to the priesthood during Joseph Smith's lifetime, Q. Walker Lewis and Elijah Abel, with possibly a third. There are no known first-hand statements from Joseph Smith about priesthood or temple restrictions for black saints. And that was a big deal, obviously, in the 70s when Lester Bush blew the lid off this, saying, we can't attribute this to Joseph Smith, right? So that's something to consider. Elijah Abel was the only black saint known to have participated in temple ordinances during Joseph Smith's lifetime. So Elijah Abel, a black priesthood holder and a black Latter-day Saint, he participates in the Kirtland Temple. In statements in scripture – I might dispute that last part, but at least in statements and possibly in scripture, Joseph Smith described black people as sons of Canaan and sons of Cain. So Joseph Smith, we have him on the record sometimes using this language. Joseph Smith, obviously, he translated the Book of Abraham, which describes a lineage-based priesthood restriction related to the descendants of Canaan. Beginning in 1978, church leaders and other individuals recorded recollections that Joseph Smith had at some point begun to teach privately about priesthood restrictions for black saints. So very famously or infamously, depending on how you look at it, Zebedee Coltrane and my third great grandfather, Abraham Smoot, both go on the record saying, I remember Joseph Smith saying there should be a priesthood ban, but those are later recollections. In the 1830s, Joseph Smith held a neutral position on slavery and used the Bible to justify the position. In the 1840s, however, Joseph Smith advocated for the abolition of slavery. A few historical records available indicate that Joseph was kind to black Latter-day Saints, but also show that he maintained some racist beliefs and views that were common in the 19th century. In 1840, the first presidency stated that the Nauvoo Temple was to be a place of worship for people of every color, that's a quote, of every color, and specifically mentions Africans as participating. So for whatever it's worth, those are some of the quick facts about Joseph Smith's sort of involvement with this. I'll read real quick about Brigham Young's, and then I'll pass the mic to whoever wants to add. Brigham Young and other church leaders at the time generally believed that black people were descendants of Cain, Ham, and Canaan. That was a common belief and justification that was cited. There are no records contemporary with Joseph that indicate he taught or established a policy that black saints were to be restricted from the priesthood or temple ordinances. Some leaders reported decades later, as I mentioned, that Joseph Smith privately taught this, but that's disputed how accurate those are. Beginning in 1847, apostles began teaching that black saints could not hold the priesthood. There were some prominent white American 19th century scientists and others who believed that interracial marriage would produce widespread infertility. That was a fear Brigham Young had. On multiple occasions, black saints were allowed to serve as proxies in baptisms for the dead, which is rather significant and something that we can thank Paul Reeve for alerting us to, going through the temple records. Some members with families of African descended ancestry were endowed and sealed because they, quote, passed as white. That's another thing that Reeve points out. We do have people who absolutely are descendants from African persons or who have black ancestry. They receive the endowment. They receive priesthood blessings, right? Or they receive the priesthood and their endowment. Some black saints petitioned the church presidents for priesthood and temple blessings, but their requests were denied. Famously, Jane Manning James did this. And finally, this again, for whatever it's worth, as people wrestle with this, Brigham Young and his successors taught that God would eventually lift the priesthood restriction. So there was the sense of one day God will lift this, but they were very noncommittal on what that would look like until, obviously, God did lift it, right? Until Spencer Buchemann got a very clear revelation. So there are some of the quick facts for listeners. They can check out the sources we've recommended to do a deeper dive if they'd like. But as you can tell, it's messy. Like, just going through that, yeah. There's lots of data. There's lots of historical context. It's very messy and complicated. And hopefully that can help better contextualize this as we better understand it. And I think importantly, move beyond it and listen to modern prophets who are very clear and unequivocal on the importance of rooting out racism from the church, condemning racism in the church, and combating that.
Yeah, and so you mentioned, I mean, just to highlight how complicated it is that you've got people like Zebedee Coltrane and Abraham Smoot saying that they remember Joseph Smith teaching a priesthood ban. And then I think I remember Paul Reeve talking about Joseph F. Smith recalling that Joseph Smith had taught that, but Paul Reeve attributes that to a false memory. And so there's clearly messy, messy documentation about, you know, these are firsthand testimonies, but they're lay. How seriously do we take them? And so trying to sift through when it actually started. I mean, the historical data definitely points to it starting with Brigham Young, not Joseph Smith, but that doesn't mean everything is clear cut when you're right. going through these documents. It can be really challenging to kind of parse it all and to figure out what's going on. And, you know, it's one thing to determine data points in documents. It's an entirely other endeavor to attribute intention and meaning behind them and creating a narrative behind the documents that you put together. So this is just it's fascinating and it's very interesting. And it's been a long, hard struggle for many members of the church, understandably. One thing I think might be useful is since, well, this topic isn't necessarily my strong suit, but scripture tends to be our strong suit. And we do know that there have been scriptural justifications for the ban over time that people have drawn on over the centuries as they're wondering, well, why does this ban exist? They turn to the scriptures, they find things that tend to confirm what they think. And so those tend to be perpetuated. We've got some scriptures in the book of Abraham that people have used to point to a justification for the temple ban. Well, you've got like a reference to how Pharaoh was not of the lineage that held priesthood. And then you also have the story about Ham's descendants and Canaan being cursed. Therefore, they couldn't have the priesthood. And then you've also got in the Book of Mormon an example of a people who are cursed with a skin of blackness that has been interpreted in various ways. And you kind of look at all of those things and wonder, okay, well, maybe all of that constellation of scripture means that blacks really are cursed and they really shouldn't have the priesthood. But when you take each one individually on its own terms and in its own context, again, there's a more complicated background there, and you can kind of parse out what's really going on. And most of the time, this is not talking about a racial ban. I mean, Stephen, you're more versed on the Book of Abraham instances.
And we talked about all those Book of Abraham examples last time because we had Book of Abraham as our topic last time.
But you're right, Jasmine. There's it's easy to come to a priesthood ban from the scriptures if you bring with you into your reading a widely held assumption that was held in the 19th century and before that descendants of Ham equal black people, right? And if you bring with you that like sort of pre-programmed reading, which was – this wasn't Latter-day Saints. This was Muslims and Jews and Christians for centuries before have the same understanding. It's easy to arrive there. And so a part of me kind of doesn't – fault them too much for getting there because it's easy to get there. But nonetheless, I still think that reading is an error. And I've argued why. Others have argued why. And yes, you get these passages from Pearl Gray Price and a couple from the Bible, and you bring with you this sort of racial assumption about how this works, and voila, you have a priesthood ban. And it turns out that today the church is like, but all those reasons were wrong. Like the church like officially doesn't ascribe to any of those reasons anymore. And all the justifications were given were wrong, and all the theories were given were wrong, right? That's been very clear. So, yeah, you're going to see in the historical record, frankly, contradictory statements or accounts about why there's a priesthood ban. Is it because of Cain? He murdered his brother, and he was marked with black skin. Is it because Noah cursed Canaan, his grandson, and he was cursed with black skin? Is it because of Pharaoh? Is it because in the pre-existence they weren't valiant enough? Well, that's what Orson Hyde thought, but Brigham Young absolutely don't think that. He repeatedly says, no, that's not true, right? So the reasons, they just throw any reasons they can to justify this thing, and it took Revelation finally to say, like, it's basically all wrong. And we're sort of left here to sort of pick up the pieces with what you do with that, right?
It's true, like you said. I mean, all of those can't be true at the same time. If you've got Cain and then his grandson and then Pharaoh, like, it's got to – okay, yeah.
And to their credit, I will say, guys like Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie, they will say, we were wrong about that. So Joseph Fielding Smith famously once says, I was asked about the premortal existence theory that the blacks were less valiant in the premortal war or whatever. And I had always believed it, and then finally someone kind of forced me to look at it carefully, and I said, oh, it's actually not there. What do you know? And Bruce McConkie famously, right, said, forget everything I ever said, George Q. Cannon. We spoke with limited understanding. So, like, I guess to their credit, right? Like, once they realize this, they back down from it.
That's super admirable.
I actually think that's one of the most important things Bruce McConkie did as part of his ministry. He, as you know, was a very doctrinaire character, or a very, we must do it by the book, or...
A very...
By the scriptures and in the Lord's way.
Yeah.
And it is known that he held these views initially, but when the revelation came, he recognized the error and reversed himself. And he's not a person that would have reversed himself short of revelation.
Yeah.
And so I think that actually was an essential part of his ministry, because he was able to have the background of integrity, of faithfulness to the truth as in whatever degree he had seen it previously. And with that background of integrity, could reverse himself meaningfully, if that makes sense. And that's something he only would have done with revelation.
Yeah, one thing I really enjoyed, so without disclosing too much necessarily, but I recently participated in some, we'll call them workshops, I suppose, of discussing the history of the priesthood ban and the documents. And the people I was discussing this with, one of them, he was actually there in the tabernacle in June of 1978 when Spencer McKimball announced this revelation, right? Like rather, he was there in October when they sustained it in 1978, right, at October General Conference. And this fellow, he's a Latter-day Saint historian, and he was leading us in this workshop on the history of this. He made a great observation that I basically totally agree with. It was kind of a paradigm shift for myself, too, in some ways. When you go through the documentation, as we've belabored here, right, it's very messy, it's complicated, it's contradictory, and it took revelation to cut through all of that. And so this Latter-day Saint historian, a very faithful, wonderful man, he said, I don't know the reasoning or if there was reasoning for what happened. I don't know if it's from God or if it was or whatever. I don't know how the policy was supposed to work. What I do know is that Spencer B. Kimball received an unambiguous, a clear, a powerful revelation ending it. And that cut through and settled the issue. And so we can sort of retrospectively try to make sense of what was happening. But like in terms of if we take seriously that there's modern prophets and we look to modern prophets, we look to what Spencer B. Kimball said and not to what Brigham Young or George Q. Cannon said on this issue, right?
Yeah.
And that's our advantage we have as Latter-day Saints, right? But that was a kind of a powerful way to look at it is – to your point, Hales, right? It took revelation to cut through all the confusion and to finally resolve it.
Right.
And what people have to decide for themselves, are they comfortable with the fact that it, and some people thinking it took a little long, right? 1978. Well, some people think, why wasn't it received earlier? That's where faith on the Lord and his timing comes into play.
Well, and I think if I could speak to that issue a little bit, because I do think it takes one of President Nelson's favorite things, right, is good information leads to good revelation, right? And so there needed to be good information, but that doesn't mean even when you can have all the good information in the world and it can still be really unclear what you actually need to do. And this is exactly what we're saying is the historians have done the work. We have better information about what happened here than ever before. And it's actually creating additional confusion and things like that in some ways. It takes that revelation to cut through. But when people ask why it took so long, you know, one of the things that has always kind of bothered me is when the Lord wanted polygamy to happen, he didn't just like wait on Joseph Smith to do it or whatever, right? Like he waited for a while, but after it was clear Joseph wasn't doing it, he sends an angel with a drawn sword and says, look, Joseph, you've got to do this. And I realize we're stepping into a whole nother dicey topic here with with polygamy that we don't want to get into right now. But what always bothered me was, well, why doesn't God send an angel with a flaming sword to Brigham Young and say, stop this racist thing, don't do that. And that's what vexes me here for this. And I don't know that I have a good answer, but the thing that always comes up for me is you had to, like, hearts had to change.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
And you can't force that to happen by just having an angel appear with a drawn sword.
Right. Are you going to have an angel appear to the whole church with a drawn sword?
Yeah, like it takes.
Execute all of them if they don't.
We
abandon their social.
We as a people needed to repent. That's the bottom line. We as a people needed to repent, and our hearts needed to change, and that took generations. And I think it's a little bit of a cop out if you want to put that on God and blame Him. Like, no, this is our fault. This is our fault. And when you understand that, you understand that you've got to be part of that solution now, right? Like, we're still trying to heal and repair the damage, and you've got to be a part of that because, well, we didn't live during that era, right? But, you know, as a collectively, as a people, right, it was our fault. God wanted to fix it all along, but hearts had to change.
I liken it to the children of Israel in the wilderness,
yeah,
because that's another clear example where the biblical account makes it clear that this was their fault, that they weren't getting in there. It was because they were afraid, they were apprehensive, they were uncertain, they feared man more than God, right, that sort of thing. So, I think that there's some wisdom there, Neil, and we just have to kind of own that, right? That's part of this reckoning that we're sort of seeing these days, is be honest about it and own it, and like just acknowledge the fact that we are all fallen humans, and that includes we sometimes do terrible racist things, and that sometimes includes prophets and church leaders, and that's part of the program. And we all are Paul Reeve actually has a great line. I like it. He says, I don't need an infallible prophet because I have an infallible savior, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
if we can recognize that, that might be able to help sort of recalibrate our expectations as we approach the subject.
And that we still have work to do as well. I mean, I find it very inspiring to read about the ending of the ban and how President Kimmel received that revelation, the reception among the 12, all of the powerful spiritual witnesses that led up to that moment are really inspiring. There's a great article in BYU Studies called Spencer W. Kimball and the Revelation on Priesthood. And it has a lot of beautiful, inspiring anecdotes and recollections of that time. And it can kind of leave you with a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling of, oh, aren't we so glad that, you know, that's over. But the reality is we still have work to do and that we're still healing and we're still trying to work on making sure that we live up to the ideals set out in the Book of Mormon, that all are equal before God and that we are all of God's children and we need to do our best to make sure that everyone feels that. I think Elder Christofferson gave a really important talk in General Conference on the doctrine of belonging. And, you know, this isn't the same as the kind of social justice that the world preaches. This is a social advocacy that the gospel preaches, that we are all children of God and that we all need to be united in this work together, and that requires doing hard work from all of us and confronting our own past and making sure we're working towards a better future.
I mean, Zion needs to be of one heart and one mind in order to happen.
Yeah.
And until we've all gotten there, we've had a lot more to
do. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. So I think that's everything we have to say on that topic. It was maybe more than we had thought we were going to say, but
well, there's a lot to talk about, right?
You know? Yeah.